Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can hear us online on DogWorksRadio.com. And calling in from Southern California is our co-host. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going very well, Robert. How you were on the road a little bit.
Yeah, I was on the road for a couple of weeks. I did some swift water rescue in the mountains of California and then headed to the East Coast to a roller coaster conference.
That is very, very cool.
It starts the summer off right, I guess.
Yeah. So down here, we're sort of in the, although it's not technically June yet, we're in the kind of June gloom period where the marine layer just socks us in overnight, and then sometimes it burns off and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, you know, here in Alaska, it is definitely a beautiful spring. Even though it's rainy, we definitely need it here to suppress a lot of that fire danger that happens when it's so dry here in the summer. But it's becoming a beautiful summer. The leaves are out and the plants are blooming.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of my friends in Southeast Alaska have been complaining a lot about how much it rains, but then when you press them, they all say, yeah, I guess we actually need it.
Speaking of summer, there's a lot of stuff happening in the off-season on Iditarod, isn't that right?
There is, and it's surprising because we've seen two very, very big stories break in Iditarod in the past couple weeks, and you know, there's usually some news that breaks in the off-season, but I don't recall so much happening in such a short amount of time in the off-season before, or maybe it did and I just wasn't aware of it.
Well, you know, sort of the official start of the Iditarod year happens in the last Saturday, the last weekend or the last Saturday of June, where they do the volunteer picnic and the first day of signups, and that's usually sort of the thing that kicks everything off. They also have a teachers' conference at that time. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Alex, maybe you know, that's when they also announce the next year's teacher on the trail. Is that right?
Yes, I believe that's right.
So before we have had some news break, and I don't know if it's good, bad, or indifferent, but that's what we're going to talk about today, right?
Right, and you know, we're actually, I guess, we're kind of lucky because we're in that period where the signups haven't happened yet, and it is, I believe, far enough away from the end of Iditarod, so mushers can speak up about these things. And we've talked a lot about the gag rule, the so-called gag rule, in the past, and I believe we are in the period where it's far enough from the end of the race so that mushers can actually speak up about whatever they want to.
Has that ever hindered anybody that you know of to date? I know that's a couple of years old now, but I don't think, at least in terms of social media, not a whole lot of people have bitten their tongue, have they?
You know, it's hard to tell how much they would have said without it. A lot of mushers are not really hugely public about a lot of these things. Anyway, a lot of people feel like the stuff that happens that's specific to the Iditarod and specific to the mushing community is something that they will freely talk about in that community, but not as much outside that community. But you are right. There are a lot of people who seem to have found a way to speak up anyway, even with this gag rule in place.
So let's kick this off. And the first one is sort of a I guess it's sort of a non-issue compared to the other ones, but the first piece of news I have is I saw in my travels just a quick blurb come across that over the next couple of Iditarods, it's going to be ran on the southern route only. As you know, they typically alternate years, you know, northern and southern route, corresponding with odd and even years. And then, of course, with weather the last few years, it's had to be up in Fairbanks. And, of course, that is weather dependent. But what do you think about sticking to that same trail for the next couple of years?
You know, I think a lot of people miss it. They haven't run the Southern Route, I believe, since 2013, because we had both 2017 and 2015, which would have been Southern Route years. They switched the startup to Fairbanks. So I think you know, some people who've wanted to run the Southern Route will get a chance. I think people, you know, miss being able to go through the ghost town of Iditarod itself. Weather permitting, I think that's fine. I don't really have a strong opinion about it, but it seems okay to me.
Well, if we could add just a little bit of controversy to this, I don't know the answer. Maybe you do, but does the Southern Route have anything to do with that issue they had a few years ago with the Donlin Gold and, you know, the passing of that particular area of the trail? I guess they were going to close a part because of the gold mining and that sort of thing. Does that have anything to do with this?
I honestly am not sure. My guess would be that it probably doesn't, but I'm not 100% positive. I mean, traditionally, the reason for alternating between the northern and southern routes has been that a lot of these villages that the race passes through are literally very, very tiny, and the thought is that it would be too overwhelming to have the race go through some of these villages every year. You know, we're talking about villages that maybe have populations of you know, a couple dozen up to maybe 75 or 100 people. So to have the circus kind of come through town, and you know, all of the people, all of the race officials, some of the media, you know, all of the supplies that have to go through there, that can really stress a small community that doesn't have a lot of resources.
Right. All right, so let's jump into sort of the meat of the show. I know that this is on a lot of people's minds, and in particular the first portion of our show where we talk about a couple of the rules that have been upheld. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about the trailer rules and the up until a couple years ago, or I guess up until 2017, a lot of people were having trailers behind the main sled where they would be able to put dogs to rest dogs. And I think the first person who started doing this was Jeff King a while ago, but it was really taken to the next level by Dallas and Mitch Seavey, who sort of, you know, made a big strategy out of resting a bunch of dogs at a time so that they would always have their dogs in peak form so they could go as fast as possible. And, you know, obviously the two of them have been just completely dominant in the past, I guess, 6 years or so.
Right.
And then in 2017, the rules were changed so that you could not haul dogs behind the sled. And what Dallas did in particular was he had his sponsor, J.J. Keller, build him this high-tech customized sled that had little compartments where he could keep, I believe, four dogs. So they were in front of him, so it was legal according to the way the rules had changed. But some people were wondering if this wasn't perhaps trying to find the technicality so that he could still do the thing that the Iditarod was trying to get rid of. And then in this latest meeting of the ITC, the rules committee voted 4-3 to change the rules again to basically outlaw those kind of sleds. So now the only way that you can haul dogs is if they are in front of the sled, in front of the driver, and are visible. So you could have them sort of sticking out from the sled bag, but you couldn't have them in a compartment underneath, which is what Dallas did.
You know, my first thought on that when you mentioned visible was in all races that I've ever been a part in, you have to have a bag that will safely contain a dog in the bag itself, meaning zipped up in the bag. It becomes a safety concern to me when the dogs have to be visible. I've done it many times where the dogs have worked their way out of the zippers and there you are going down the trail at 10 miles an hour or whatever it is, and you have one hand on the bar and one hand on the dog, and the dog is trying to jump out and get back in the team and all of this. That can become a real safety hazard.
Yeah, and, you know, it's hard to see this as a lot of people and a lot of mushers have been very vocal about not liking this rule change. Wade Morris, who is going to be on the mushers' representative to the ITC, spoke out against it after the rule change. He's not yet allowed to vote, but he had asked the board to get rid of all restrictions on hauling dogs so that you would go back to how it had been a couple of years ago where you could put dogs in trailers behind. The rules committee includes Rick Swenson, Lance Mackey, Pete Kaiser. They voted 4-3 for this rules change, and some people on Facebook were saying that they felt like Rick Swenson, who's the only 5-time winner, was trying to prevent Dallas from winning his 5th Iditarod. I'm not really sure that I buy that, just because that doesn't ring true to me. And also, I think, you know, you can put Dallas off for a couple of years, but at some point Dallas is going to win his 5th Iditarod. That seems almost inevitable to me.
He's in his early 30s, or if just turned 30 not too long ago. Man, there's
right.
Still people out there that are mushing in their 70s thinking about Jim Lanier. Of course, he knows that nobody is going to win it at 70, but I guess if you've been running the race for 40-some years and you have such a good strategy that the CVs have, and in Dallas in particular, it's bound to happen, at least I think.
I think so, too. And, you know, maybe nobody is going to win in their 70s, but Jeff King is Jeff King is 61, and he nearly won a couple years ago when he was in his late 50s.
Right.
So, you know, certainly I think it's more than, and, you know, Mitch Seavey has won in his 50s. So it's definitely possible that Dallas, if he continues to have good dogs, will be someone who is a serious competitor for the next several decades.
Right.
And, you know, you never can say what's going to happen, but it seems that sometime in the next 25 years, Dallas Seavey will win the Iditarod probably a lot more than once.
So, Alex, before we get into sort of a fan's perspective on this particular rule and sort of the musher's perspective, at least what we've read, what's the next rule that they talked about? It's the cell phone rule, right?
Right. So they voted to keep the cell phone rule basically the way it was last year. So so mushers will be able to use cell phones to communicate, to make phone calls. They will not be allowed to use the cell phones to get any sort of coaching or race advice information. We talked about that a lot before the race last year, and it seemed like that almost was a non-issue. I don't remember hearing very much about that at all. I think there were probably only a few mushers who had cell phones or satellite phones. As we discussed, there, unless you have a satellite phone specifically, most of the area on the trail, you're not going to have service on a cell phone. So you maybe would have a little bit of service in, I think, Unalakleet. But aside from that, I'm not sure there's anywhere that that it would really be helpful.
You know, and that's my thought on it as well. I don't remember hearing anything about it, good, bad, or indifferent, about, oh my goodness, so-and-so was using a cell phone on the side of the trail or at the checkpoint or whatever. I just don't think it became a real issue like they thought it was going to be. But I think more than anything, Alex, at least in my opinion, a lot of this stemmed back to the Brent Sass ordeal a few years ago where he was disqualified for having an iPod Touch, I believe it was. He said that it did not have Wi-Fi capabilities. But I think by having the cell phone rule in place, whether you use it as a phone or not, you know, just I know I do. I don't know about you, but I use my phone for everything. It's not only my phone, but it's also, you know, my computer when I'm on the road. It's also what I use for taking pictures. It's what I use for music. And if they have that rule in place where you're allowed to have it, that essentially makes that iPhone a non-issue. You can have it on the trail, whether using it as a phone or a music player or as a camera or whatever. You still have that ability with the phone being allowed. Do you agree?
Yeah, and I think that probably is the biggest difference that it's made, is that rather than having to get an iPod, and now we're talking about an iPod that's several generations old, and something else, and then something else for a camera, you can just have your one device, and you can use it, and it probably is not going to be that useful as a phone, but that's okay.
But it would be usable as a GPS, and I know nowadays they have those fuel packs, those battery recharging packs that you can plug into your phone, and you know it will charge your phone a couple of times. So you could realistically use that iPhone or whatever type of phone that you have as a GPS. I don't think that's bad either, because GPSs have been allowed for the last few years, if not almost a decade.
Yeah, and you know, even though we do have this technology, so you can theoretically recharge it, let's not forget that any of these kind of devices, when you're using them in extreme cold,
right,
they're not going to hold a charge for very long, and they're going to lose charge just by being cold. So you're going to have to keep the phone near your body, near where your body heat can keep the battery warm. So even with the recharging, this is not something people are going to be using all the time. It'll maybe be something that if someone needed it as a GPS, they could turn it on and use it briefly to get oriented.
Right. Okay, so what is your opinion of both of these rules as they stand right now from a fan's perspective?
I go back and forth about the hauling dogs thing. And what Rick Swenson said is that he wanted it to get back to, to get back to sort of the old school Iditarod, where your dogs would be running. So you would run your dogs, and pretty much the dogs that, unless you drop them, the dogs would run all the way to Nome. I like that idea in theory, but I don't actually see anything that wrong with resting dogs temporarily. And I know that this is somewhat controversial, and a lot of people think, well, this is, it turns it into a different kind of race. But my feeling is, you know, it's not the race that it was in 1973 and 1974 anyway, because the trail is very well broken. You don't have, you know, mushers will say that they're still required to use snowshoes, but they never pretty much have to wear them. They're not out breaking trail. So I'm not sure that I have a problem with the race evolving in this way, especially if it's something that can maybe make it a little bit more friendly to to sponsors and to fans. And it does seem to me like what they're doing is sort of twisting themselves up in knots to try to get people not to haul dogs.
Right.
And I'm not sure that that's I'm not sure that's the right way to go about it.
Well, from a Russian...
And I hadn't thought of it before you mentioned it, but it does seem like, you know, having to keep the dogs visible at all times could definitely be a safety issue and could definitely, you know, you would run into issues where potentially you could have more dogs who are, if they're being rested, you'd have more dogs who are getting loose or running away and having to be chased.
Okay, from a musher's perspective, at least in my opinion only, I don't have a problem with the hauling of the dogs either, whether they're in the front of the sled or the back of the sled or whatever. In my opinion, I think it allows the same advantage to everybody. Everybody has the ability to haul dogs. Now, there is no steadfast rule about the size of sled that you're allowed to have in terms of length. You know, so you can have a really short sled, which a lot of people use, almost like a mid-distance type, where it would be very difficult to haul more than one dog. Or some people have very long sleds, the old toboggan type, heavy-duty, hardcore sleds, where you could realistically haul three or four dogs in the sled. I think that that's the evolution of the race. It's very similar. I know we've talked about sort of comparing the Iditarod to other sports. Dogs these days are much more specialized than they were in the early days. You have dogs that are particularly used for, you know, the first third of the race, where they're the bigger, heavier dogs that go up and over the mountains that are required to pull much heavier loads. You have the fast, sprintier type dogs that are used on the coast in the last third. And then you just have sort of the all-around dog that can, you know, finish the race no matter what. So I think that, at least in my opinion, that's sort of the evolution of the sport and the evolution of the dog itself.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page about this. It seems like the ITC is fighting a battle I'm not sure they can really win. And I think there seems to be a lot of blowback from the mushers, and I've heard a lot of people saying that they feel like the ITC is completely ignoring what the mushers want. And you know, that's not something that you want to, you don't want to get the ITC at war with the mushers, certainly.
Right. And, you know, we've talked about this, and I just want to spend about a minute or so longer on this topic before we move into the second one. You know, we've talked about it before, how right now the mushers don't really have a voice. And you talked about the rules committee, and you mentioned a couple of names there, Rick Swenson and now Wade Mars. You talked about Lance Mackey and Pete Kaiser. Those are all Iditarod mushers, and they know exactly what's happening out there on the trail. But unlike other sports, and in the NFL in particular, you know, they have the collective bargaining agreements, and they have the unions and all that. Until that happens, I don't think that they're going to have an equal voice. And I think the Iditarod sees it as, it's our race. You can come and race it if you want. If not, there's other things to do.
Yeah, and I understand that, but I worry that that if there's enough of an outcry, that it could really hurt the Iditarod, and it could, you know, hurt the Iditarod's standing as really the premier and most famous and most well-regarded of the dog sled races. So I would hate to have them do something like that and have, you know, a whole bunch of mushers say, well, this is ridiculous, we're not going to do this.
Hmm. You know, I definitely think that this is a show that we could talk about much further. I think it's a great topic that we could get some feedback on, you know, on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. I don't think it's going to be something that's going to go away anytime soon, but I definitely want to spend a little bit of time on the next story. And we have about 5 minutes, Alex, so we want to make sure that we can cover this as best as we can. Just recently, a very high-profile sponsor pulled out of the race. I think that was just this week, maybe yesterday or the day before. Wells Fargo said that they were no longer going to be involved with the race, and they were, I believe, what they call a lead dog sponsor, which is up to $250,000. What do you know about this, and what do you think the outcome of it is going to be?
Yeah, so this this seems to have broken, I think, on Monday, where Craig Medred from craigmedred.news broke this story that Wells Fargo was pulling out of the Iditarod, and according to the press release that the Iditarod issued, it was because Wells Fargo was pressured by PETA. We talked a lot about the Sled Dog documentary that was shown in film festivals, and I believe is going to be shown on Canadian television, and that seemed to reignite the PETA protests that that seemed to pop up most years around Iditarod, but they had been relatively quiet the last 3 or 4 years. So this seemed to reignite them. They were pressuring a bunch of the Iditarod sponsors, including sponsors who sponsor at a higher level, like I think ExxonMobil is a higher level sponsor of Iditarod. And, you know, Wells Fargo has been a sponsor for almost 30 years, back to when it was the National Bank of Alaska, and then they were bought by Wells Fargo. But they've been a very vocal, supportive sponsor of Iditarod for a very long time. Not only pouring a lot of money into the race, but having hospitality booths at the start and sometimes at the end some years, and they've sponsored the Gold Coast Award every year for at least the last few years that I've been aware of. So this is a fairly large thing. The ITC is pointing out that Wells Fargo in Alaska is still very supportive of the race, but this was a decision made by the corporate Wells Fargo with their headquarters in San Francisco.
So real quickly, Alex, what are your thoughts in terms of a fan? Think again, if this was another sport, let's say Budweiser or Pepsi or Chevy or Ford or somebody all of a sudden pulled out of the Super Bowl, what would your thoughts be on that compared to how it is with Iditarod now?
You know, I think it's actually a little more serious with Iditarod, just because there aren't as many corporate sponsors at this level. And unlike the Super Bowl, where people are just elbowing each other to get into it, this is a little bit more of a hard sell, at least in corporate America. So it's troublesome to me. It worries me that that PETA has been able to make this kind of difference. And, you know, we can do a whole show on PETA sometime. And my opinion is basically they cherry-pick and misrepresent information to make things look horrible when that is far from the truth. So it bothers me that they've done that. I also wonder how much of this is Wells Fargo has been having a lot of problems as a company. There was a big scandal with them signing up people for additional accounts without their knowledge. They just got hit with a fairly huge fine. A lot of people I know have been taking their money out of Wells Fargo and moving it to other banks or credit unions. So I think that all, you know, plays a part in this, but I would be very worried about other large sponsors and want to make sure that the Iditarod is shoring up their relationships with other people who might also, you know, be headquartered outside of Alaska and be getting cold feet about it.
So in 15 seconds, Alex, do you think that this is going to have a detrimental impact on this year's race with a large sponsor like this pulling out at this time?
I don't think it will have a big influence on this next race, but I'm worried about 2019 and would really be, if I were the ITC, be really making sure that I was lining up sponsors and solidifying those relationships.
Excellent. All right, Alex, we are out of time. We are doing it live here on KVR, so we got to make sure we pay attention to the clock. We will talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.